Blog Talk Radio.
Fill my eyes with poetry. Happy Friday. Happy, happy Friday. Hope everyone had a great week. And as always, I hope you have a better weekend to follow. Hey, Rex, how are you tonight?
I'm just fine. What's up?
Not too much. Not too much. I got my. That was a great save. Thank you. I got that up and ready to roll. And it's good to have you here, as always. Yeah, there's not a whole lot happening. Quiet day, you know, in my world. Ran around this morning and just kind of got nice and, I don't know, it just leveled out today. I was, like, very thankful, actually. So that's always a big plus. Yeah, it looks like we have a great board tonight. What do we have? We have, like, 19 up, I think. And we have, I don't know, 7 audios. So we're in good shape in that respect. And I think we have some people calling him.
Cool.
So sounds like a good night. I actually have 2 people on the line already. Imagine that.
Yep.
So I'm going to find out who they are. See. Hello, 503, calling, please.
This is Emmy. Hello.
Hi, Emmy. How are you today?
Hey, Emmy.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. Good, thanks. It's good to have you. And then
we
have area code
6. Nice to be here.
Good, very good. Hello, 630. Who's calling, please?
Hey, guys, it's Colin. Can you hear me okay?
Hey, Colin. Yes, we can. Well, at least I can. I don't want to speak for anybody else.
See Francis Higgins on the site. But you can call me, Colin.
It's good to have you. The area code kind of threw me. I'm like, I don't know who that is. So, it's good to have you here as well. Happy Friday. Oh, my goodness, my goodness. So, yeah, everyone doing good this week? Colin? Emmy?
Yeah, it's been hot here.
Yeah? Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
I think it's been really hot places. Kind of crazy, you know. And anywhere it's cold, well, you know, I think I'm envious. But it's all good. It's all good. We all have heat and air conditioning, thank God. Let's put it that way. So, at least most of us. Fans? Anything? I don't know. Libraries? Malls? I don't know. It's tough. It is tough. Anyhow, let me see. Now that I've stumbled all over my thoughts and stuff, life is just grand. exactly, you know. Rex, you got anything? I do want to start out by telling everybody there is no Parts and Reports tonight after midnight at 12:30. Fabian is not feeling so good, and Babbler is out of town. So we're going to postpone that show until next Saturday morning. So I do want to give everybody a heads up, and hopefully I'll remember to do that again before the end of the show. And I already told Joe Rex, that's his job to remind me. You know, got to tell the truth. Somebody's got to help me remember stuff. So let's see. I guess, Rex, is there anything that you wanted to talk about? Say anything before we get started? I don't know.
No, it's just
what's happening on?
It's Grand Funk Railroad for Sunday night. That's about it.
Hello, that's something. Definitely something. That's awesome. That's awesome, awesome, awesome. Oh, and I wanted to say to Josie, welcome back. I'm glad to know you're back on All Poetry, and hopefully your music will kick in, and you will be writing soon. Poetry, but she's back. She's been away for a while. So had a little note from her earlier, and that it was good to see her. So hopefully we'll be hearing from her soon. Okay.
Cool.
So, yeah. Like all these little surprises, happy notes. That was a happy note today. I know she's been going quite a while. So let me see now. I guess I should get my act together and get us started. All right. Oof. You know, otherwise I'll just chatter all night long. I mean, nobody wants to sit and hear that all night. Trust me.
Yeah, don't we have
Songs
for Shadows coming up soon?
What is it? Oh, yes, the Solace of Shadows. Robert M. is back with the Solace of Shadows. I was hoping he would have called in last week. I don't know if he's calling in tonight. But, yes, his first show is next. I say Sunday morning. It's an after midnight show, and it'll be right after Captain B2 and Dan DeShino,
Ekphrasis.
Yes, it's Ekphrasis, but it's the Exploring Ekphrasis. There we go.
Oh, okay.
After that show will be the Solace of Shadows with Robert M., and I hope everyone will take the opportunity to join in. I'm sure it'll be a wonderful show. There's a contest up if anyone's interested. It's about nightmares. So, the way to start it off. Yes. Thanks for reminding me of that, because I probably wouldn't have thought of it until the middle of the show when I couldn't talk. Good job. See? I'll tell you. It's rough when you ain't got a memory of your own. I write notes and then I forget where I wrote them, so, you know, I just forget it. Okay. Rex, I'm going to have you start us off with this one here by Scott Sharp, The Massacre at Wounded Knee.
There it is. The Massacre at Wounded Knee, December 1890, by Scott Sharp. Lakota Warrior, face painted, red with blackened eyes, wore pink, white vertical stripes connecting heaven and earth, dance in leather rawhide, moccasin, breech cloth, and full feathered headdresses of ghostiness unnerves the white settlers. Icy waters trickle along Wounded Knee Creek. Storms stir the muddy waters where Major Samuel Whiteside's regiment of the 7th Cavalry leads Chief Spotted Elk and Minneconjou Lakota near Porcupine Buttes, away from the reservation and the ghost dance ceremonies. Ominous gray clouds disarm themselves. Snow falls upon the high plains. Meanwhile, the remainder of the 7th Cavalry, led by Colonel Forsythe, encircle the makeshift camp by the Cascading Creek to execute the disarmament of the Lakota tribesmen at sunrise. Rifles at the ready, focused guns sit north, south, east, and west. The brazen sun rises to stifle the rebellious cold. Impatient troops move like buffalo, stampeding, ready to disarm the Indian warriors. The warriors, outnumbered, stand in the brisk morning air outside their teepees, staring down the rifle barrel, surrendering their arms. Black Coyote, deaf and confused, does not understand, simply refuses as his rifle costs him a great deal. An old Lakota man just feet away starts chanting and dancing, ghost dance, a prayer to rid the Indians of the white invaders, chanting, dancing, singing. A soldier grabs Black Coyote's gun. It goes off. Panic stirs as 30-caliber bullets whiz like bees flying by an ear as the soldiers shoot once, then a series of blasts before the Hotchkiss gun spray, dropping bodies into the gulch. Warriors, children, women holding babies, spring to foot, running into the ravine. The volley of lead hums a solemn song in the gray morning light as snowflakes fall to the ground to make a blanket for the dead bodies, frozen in the cold, the unforgiving ground of history. Massacre by Wounded Knee Creek, where the Lakota are buried in a mass grave. 300 spirits planted in the South Dakota soil as the roots of the tribal tree are uprooted. And poem. Andy, why don't we start with you, please?
Were you starting with me?
Yes, please.
Yes.
Yeah, this is... This is a kind of like one of those history poems that I really appreciate to see, because it's not just a matter, I mean, this is a factual story. This actually did happen. I remember reading this poetry last week, actually, because I was kind of reading ahead and I looked it up on Wikipedia. It was a very horrible time in human history. I think the part that I think is really, really great about this piece in particular is, it's the brazen sun rises to stifle the rebellious cold. This, as well as just impatient troops move like buffalo stampeding, there's a great use of thematics there, sort of like a cohesion of like each and every single detail actually matches the overall themes that are present within the poem. And I don't think it's very often that poets or writers, for that matter, really take that into consideration. And so it's always lovely to see that. I think this was an absolutely great piece and definitely a very harrowing piece. But yeah, that's what I had to say about it.
Excellent. Thank you, Emmy. And Colin, how about you?
Yeah. Aside from the attention to historical detail, which is apparent here, you know, what strikes me about this is not simply the subtle poetic expressions, you know, for instance, the roots of the tribal tree are uprooted, but it's the almost matter of fact and almost neutral way that this whole thing unfolds, which I think adds to the horror. It almost reads like a newspaper account. It's almost like a poetic newspaper account of what happens. And there's no moralizing here. That there's no grandstanding or ethical statements. It's just basically shows you what happened, the enormity of what happened, and the subtle impact that it had on our history, and in that way, it makes it all the more effective. So it's wonderfully done, and very effective.
Great comment there, Colin. Thank you. And Jean, how about you?
Well, you know, I thought this was an incredible recounting of historical events. I think that Scott has a way with this kind of a write, because I've seen him do it a couple of occasions. You know, painful imagery and detail, very, very well done and put together piece. The accounting of what happened is just, he didn't miss much, you know, I don't think. You know, I can't tell you, I'm not the great history buff, but when he starts here, panic stirs as 30 caliber bullets whiz like bees flying by an ear. As the soldiers shoot once, then a series of blasts, before the Hotchkiss guns spray, dropping bodies into the gulch. Warriors, children, women holding babies, spring to foot, running into the ravine. You know, it's scary. It's terrifying. You can't imagine what it must have been like for this to have taken place. You know, women holding babies and children, everyone's all running for their lives. I mean, it had to be terrifying. And I think that Scott really, you know, put it together well. So nice work, Scott, and thank you for sharing, as always. Enjoyed. I just say enjoyed on something like that.
Great comments, everybody. And Colin, you're right. This does read almost like a poetic news account. It doesn't offer, like you said, it doesn't offer up anything except the deliverance of that day itself and what happened. There is no pointed fingers. There's no this was this and this was that. It's just a matter of fact. And it does come off as not something that nobody's being blamed, nobody's being called out for it. It's just a recounting of history. And like the fact that Hotchkiss guns are introduced here, it's the Civil War that had the Gatling gun, so the Hotchkiss was the upgrade, the newest machine gun, literally, because it went on to play a big part in World War One after this. So it was an effective, very effective, too effective weapon. And the goat stance itself is something that was incorporated about a year, maybe 2 years before this actual thought. It's a call to the spirit to come stand with the warriors of today to help fight off their enemies. And it kind of hit the Indian world, and every tribe incorporated it and plus put in their own little unique variants to it. And I guess at the start of this, it kind of gave a noted history, or noted point of history, that even with that thought, the ghost dance, a lot more ghosts entered into that thought along with this horrific occasion. Nicely done, Scott. Thank you very much. All right, Gene, we're back.
Okay. Nice comments, everybody. Okay, the next piece is going to be by Shelley A.B., and it's called Mountain versus Flowers. I'm going to give this one a read. Time was like the mountain, locked in history, standing above the clouds, locked in mystery. Let me start over since I screwed it all up. So sorry. Mountains versus Flowers by Shelley A.B. Time was like the mountains, locked in history, standing above the clouds, locked in mystery. Precious like the flowers, limited life wilt, dazzling array of beauty, limits life built. Flowers grow on rocks, fragile they cling, to the crumbling cliff, fragile they swing. Love is timeless, precious but limitless, fragile but fearless. Love like the mountains, locked in history, up above the clouds, locked in mystery. End poem.
Great read, Jean. Thank you very much. And Colin, why don't we start with you, please?
Sure. I mean, a couple of things stand out here. You know, the title is Mountains versus Flowers, but it seems to me that the flowers exist on the mountains, right? which is interesting. But what really struck me, the line that I loved was, well, two lines really. It says, "Precious like the flowers, limited life wilt." And that's such an interesting line because I looked at that and you had the wilting of a flower, right, the dying of a flower, but you also have wilt as in will, do what thou wilt. So it's almost like dying but willing itself to life at the same time. So there's that double meaning there, which I thought was really interesting. And then, of course, you know, just the central metaphor, right, of something rising up into clouds that we can't really understand or apprehend just because it's transcendent. You know, and again, the rhyme scheme and the kind of musicality of the poem also really stands out. But that one line, that limited life wilt, I thought was really clever and good. So that's what stood out for me.
Nice. Thank you very much, Colin. And Amy, how about you?
Yeah, I can appreciate any poem that makes good use of flowers. I think the stanza that I liked the most probably was just the flowers grow on rocks, fragile they cling to the crumbling cliff. There's a little bit of alliteration there, which is always kind of a nice thing to see, but otherwise I think this is a pretty nice a simple poem that establishes a good contrast.
Thank you, Amy. And Jean, you got to read it. What about you?
You know, I thought it was a lovely write. I thought there were great stanzas throughout. I like how she wrapped it up with the same stanza she started with. But when you look at, she said it was inspired by nature, the timeless but fleeting beauty. And right there comes into play the lines that Colin had quoted, you know, precious like the flowers, limited life built. Nothing lasts forever, you know, everything kind of, it has its high points and then it kind of fades, as in all life, you know. Yeah, except me. I don't do that. No, I'm only kidding. But I just thought it was nicely written, and I thought she met the inspiration well. So nice. Thank you, Shelley, for sharing.
Thank you, Jean. I hit on that very same line that you did, Colin, and you expressed your thought on that quite well because I was walking on the same lines. And it does. It's a pointed note to even in the harshest of environments, you can still find beauty in nature, whether it's on a mountain where you rarely see a whole lot of things, or in a desert, or floating down a stream. It matters not. It's the thought of that which you see, that which you take in, that which you can express out of nature in the beauty offered. And this hits on that note. The quiet fragility of life, but also the fact that it keeps coming back year after year. Nicely done, Shelley. Thank you very much. All right, Jane, back to you.
Now, Emmy, I have the next one up for you by Diane D., if you don't mind.
I do not mind. Okay, let's see here. So this is The Day We Met by Diane D. One daybreak, the sun was stunning. A beige-tipped lemon meringue pie, which offered zero solitary misgive, how this was just some ordinary day. Driving to work, all lights were green, and huge giggly clouds were tittering. Just one car in line at the Tim Hortons, and they paid for my coffee and bagel. The lights from the store foyer danced, then flickered as if it was Morse code. At the rhythm glowing from the aura that our passing bodies boldly aroused. That Voca Vilva scent spun me around. I breathed in, trying not to breathe out, refusing to blink you out of my sight, for this ice cube in time may just melt. May I coax out a name, my lady of Regal, a woman painting all women as spotless. Her electric orchid smile gleamed richly as she flashed a Vogue Viva business card. Vogue Viva, I think. Yep, and poem.
Great read there.
Nice job.
Thank you very much. And Jean, why don't we start with you?
You know, I thought this was an interesting capture. You know, sometimes I use the thing, it's like a snapshot. A snapshot of that moment in time when everything just stands still. And you don't want to forget a minute of it. You don't want to forget any of the details. And I said it was just a nice capture by Diane. Very well done. Very well done. And, yeah, clever and nice work, Diane. And thanks for sharing that with us. Absolutely.
Thank you, Dean. And Colin, how about you?
Yeah, obviously what stands out is the comedic turn right at the very end, right? Yeah, but this builds into this very romantic moment where, you know, this Voce Vita, Viva sense, you're right, and the entrancing sense of this person, and you can't get them out of their mind, and you don't want to blink them out of your sight. The initial kind of connection, right, between these two people, and her electric orchid smile gleamed richly, and she flashed a Voce Viva business card, which is like, you know, very funny turn of events, because it's just like, you know, it's a, I don't even know how to explain it. It's simultaneously a letdown, but then a comedic impulse at the same time. So it's clever and funny, but also rich and poetic.
Excellent. Thank you, Colin.
Right.
And Emmy, you got to read it. How about you?
Well, there are a couple of lines that really got me. I think the huge giggly clouds were tittering. It's like a very effective adjective. I'm not often the biggest fan of adjectives, but I definitely like that as a modifier, because it really kind of sets the mood of the day. And then I also really noticed this for this ice cube in time may just melt, sort of like idea of like time kind of passing, but representing it as like an ice cube melting. So there's it was just a really great metaphor, I feel like. And yeah, it definitely was funnier towards the end. I do think a lot of people these days tend to care a lot more about finances, which is partially understandable. So yeah.
Thank you. I too like that line you picked out, and huge giggling clowns were tittering. That's a nice, almost a tender moment right there. Quiet, just to sit there and notice while driving. And that thought with the offering of Tim Hortons, and they paid for her coffee and bagel, also something you don't expect these days. But that first stanza, a beige tip lemon meringue pie, that's a great way to offer up the thought of how the sun is rising in the sky. And you get that, it looks like a glorious day, but offered up as how this was just some ordinary day. And then it gets a little better with that next one, coffee and bagel bought by the car in front. Then the next one down, the lights in the store for you dance as if Morse code. So there's a little bit more meaning going into this. And then the Voce Viva scent, which spun around. So this walked its way cleverly from an almost... just another humdrum day into a day in that last stanza, a day that's memorable because of what came to bear. Nicely done, Diane. Thank you very much. All right, Jane, we're back to you.
Okie dokie. Okay, Colin, I have the next one up for you. It's by Luke J.R. called Less... Well, never mind. I'll let you say it. Macuscular liminal? There we go.
Okay, let me see if I can find it here. Oh, here it is. Okay, let me click on this. Here we go. Lacuscular liminal. Corresponding to the invisible control routes that lead you astray, Follow the yellow brick road into a lake of decay, if you may. Emptiness is unforgiving in essence. There's a timer engraved. Where do the many wandering souls go? Should they have stayed? Within a liminal space is a yellow brick face of many stuck together. Stage from the moment the patrol twists around every corner, many would wonder if there was an emptiness in the first place. And if there is emptiness, I'm feeling empty. Where is the space? Deliveries were made to a liminal space for mere moments ago. Little did they know that there's an engraved face in the yellow brick space. With every breath that was final, everything became sudden death, while a woman walked among the stars, traveling through the liminal space, following the elements to a place that smiled with an engraved face. Through time and space, the yellow became mellow. The heart of the space became an uncoiled, fleshy, bloody face. With one last hand holding on tight, the face turned all night, and with one final breath, the woman gasped in a liminal space while the others wore masks. The woman had liminal flaps and palms.
Great read there, Colin. Thank you very much. And Amy, why don't we start with you, please?
Yeah, there was a lot of repetition I noticed in this. I think the line, follow the yellow brick road into the lake of decay, could really sort of be interpreted a number of different ways. I'm partially thinking just kind of following the road of riches and kind of the idea that everything, basically all possessions at the end of the day don't really leave you with anything at the end. But it does take kind of like a sort of like a gory turn with like the heart of the space became this uncoiled, fleshy, bloody face, and then sort of continues there, which was definitely not expected. But yeah, this is a lovely write.
Thank you, Emmy. Dean, how about you?
Well, you know, as always, I think that Luke did a nice job with the write. He always has a strong way of putting things. Sometimes he loses me, other times, you know, not so much. But I thought that this was clever, and it was a great take on the contest prompt liminal spaces. Just nicely written all the way through. And, yeah, nicely done. Great job. Yep.
Thank you, Gene. And Colin, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of ways to approach this, and you know, I could be wrong, obviously, but that these are my impressions of it. The title, Lacustrine Liminal, right, is basically a pond or a surface of water that's in between two things. And my impression here is something or somebody thinking or emerging, right, from one world into the next. And because of the yellow, the color yellow, which to me, especially in this particular poem, is death-like, right, is decay, or the color somebody turns when they're about to die, I get the impression of somebody on their deathbed. Right, with one last hand holding on tight, right, the face turned all night, right, and one last final breath. And it's the change of the faces between the person who's dying and basically leaving this world and the faces of the people that are looking upon her. That at least is my impression. It's very interesting, right? It's very abstract, right? It's extremely symbolic, but very effective. You know, where do the many wandering souls go? You know, should they have stayed, right? It's obviously there's just some sort of transition between this world and the next. But that goriness, right, and the yellow, and you know, the trying to hold on to this world are the things that stand out to me, and kind of – hold this entire thing together in one central kind of deep metaphor.
I do think you got everything right on the nose there, Colin. Yes, I quote that note to transition to, and you hit on that thought of death with the yellow. I kind of walked that way. I thought of jaundice in a moment. That note of the body not being properly functioned, so you get jaundice for the yellow that ran through this. And yeah, I did offer to go near the bottom end of this, and the traveling and where do the souls go? That question, it does offer that pondering thought of, hey, do we really know? Do we really understand? And then he hits another. And if there is emptiness, I'm feeling empty. Where's space? So again, that sort of occupying something in the moment, whereas where this finishes out, there is no occupation. The one final breath, the woman gasped in her own space. While the others wore masks, the woman had liminal glance. The thought with the mask might hit on that note of when everything was locked down, hitting on that note where the only ones that were around at the moment were those who were not loved ones, because they were being refused admittance at the time. So this might walk on that note. Thank you, Luke. All right, Jean. Back to you.
Okay, guys. Okay, the next piece I'm going to put up is called A Night Turned Sideways by DJGS. And this, thanks to Rex, has an audio. So let me hit the button. I got to find the button. There we go. Well, let's try it again.
The countertop clinks after each shot being taken. The reveling and drinking, making joy unmistaken, competing and seeking each other's validation, but leaving is needed to assure tomorrow's vocation. Submitting to the backseat of the call for assisting, resisting the tempting of leaning and sleeping, stopping and accelerating and turning to reach the destination, stationed at a red light, staring outside and waiting, hearing shattering, crashing, crumpling, and screaming. Looking forward pejoratively before realizing the horror. The car in our corridor smoking more and more. My door swings forward as I charge toward pure misfortune. Emotions delete, like a story with no order. Airbags deployed. The only one in says she's okay. Then I look away and see the other against a wall splayed. Legs move again without further delay. A race to see the state of someone's worst day. All the windows are shattered from the occurred disaster. Looking inside, two young girls, faces bloodily plastered. The driver crying, describing suffering that just happened, circumventing the crash to help out the lucky passenger first. Then a sight that instilled fright as black as the night. Another plight hiding behind the first cry. Head lying awry, unable to see eyes. Crimson face contrasting an attire so bright. Breaking the seat to reach this last casualty, crawling in, unfastening, and hearing things unsettling. A door swings, an exclaim stating impending doom rising. The ride is catching fire, igniting urgency unappetizing. Adrenaline surges, purges inability to lift, yanking, grabbing, pulling, anything to get us out of the shit. The sound of her shoes as I withdrew from the accident, dragging, scraping, and grating from the action. Gently propping her body on a wall, incessantly cropping my thoughts to deal with it all, allowing mental corralling, ensuring her existence remains continual. The visual is residual. The sensation, invocation, nothing negating wherewithal to care for her. Before I knew, my hoodie is removed, pressing through and removing blood accrued. Eyes meet, I can see her view is askew, one eye denied sight with what I'm trying to do. Robotic reactions become automatic. This unique moment indescribably tragic. The white hoodie consumed with red from what just happened. An unnatural faction of something so disastrous. The concern of preserving human life. The yearn to make learned her human right. The feeling of her breathing becoming light. the desiring of needing to make her confident, non-contrite. Minutes escaped, it's removed from my face. This moment between us lost in time and space. Despite that, to this day, I could still picture the place. A way for fate to say we're both destined to cross ways. The moment of feeling the tapping on my shoulder, seeing help has arrived and not denying better fortune. The assuring reminding that home is towards us, engorging us, destroying, tormenting thoughts.
Great read, DJ. Thank you very much for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. And I'm going to have to dig into that that thought he's got in the AN because it is quite relevant to the piece itself. I realized I had some type of PTSD. This is a description of a real night that I experienced in December 2021. This is my therapeutic way of letting emotions come out. It's not known how much being a first responder, just as a civilian, is that a horrible accident. Don't use the word hero to me. I hate it. I had first responders call me that at the scene and had to tell them to shut up. To me, a human should sacrifice their brain to being subjected to these memories in the face of human life in jeopardy. I may still have mixed emotions surrounding everything. For that, DJ. And Colin, why don't we start with you, please?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is, you know, horrifying, this whole thing. You know, it's the quatrains, you know, separated these, you know, rhyming, you know, A, B, A, B kind of stanzas, you know, seem to lend themselves towards, you know, happier images and more classical themes. But then when you dig into this, you find out that it's something very modern and very horrifying and terrible. You know, so it almost lends a certain poetic beauty to something that's just awful, right, and difficult to contend with. I think that the probably, you know, the standout for me would be the last, you know, stanza. You know, the tapping on my shoulder, seeing the help has arrived and not denying better fortune. The assuring reminding that home is towards us, right? You know, because they never made it home, right? Which is terrifying, right? Engorging thoughts and destroying tormenting thoughts. You know, the wish that, you know, that somebody could make it all better, right, at the end of the day, but nobody can, right? Because nobody can reverse what happened. So, yeah, it's a powerful piece. You know, it's well done. It's very impactful.
Excellent. Thank you, Colin. Amy, how about you?
Yeah, I also read the author's notes. I think this was just a really, really powerful and emotive piece. One line that really stuck out to me was the crimson face contrasting an attire so bright. How, that in and of itself is just, like, really kind of sets up the scene of how, like, you know, this was definitely not something that was, like, expected and not something that really should happen to people, so to speak. And then other bits of imagery. I mean, it really gets into pretty brutal territory and really doesn't pull many punches when it comes to that. The unable to see eyes, which for me, I mean, if you've ever read any stories of people being left in such a state where they're unidentifiable, for instance, that's really what that kind of reminds me of, that, you know, having a face that's, like, so bloodied that you can't actually make out certain details of it, which is really visceral stuff. And, yeah, I could probably go on about this poem, but that was sort of what was most on my mind at that point.
Thank you, Annie. And Jean, how about you? On mute, though. Jean, you there?
Yeah. 30 seconds and you got me figured out already. God. I said this was a well-penned piece, and I would also hope that it was cathartic for DJ Gio. The emotions were well expressed. And I can't imagine going through so much and walking away unscathed. You know, I don't know how anyone could really do that. I mean, I guess people do it every day, but I really think that it takes a toll on everybody to some degree. And I thought it was a very strong write and well done. So thank you, DJ GS, for sharing with me. Nice work.
Thank you, everybody. And DJ, I can relate to this as I've been in a couple of these myself, and I should never have been able to walk away from them, but I did. So, and some of it I do remember. There's a good portion I don't. There's a note to how the brain works with trauma, and it'll hide some of those, especially the real painful ones. But there are those lingering memories that do you do come across. So the fact that you use this as a way of helping to alleviate some of that anxiety, that which still lingers and pains you, is a good thing. Because in unburdening your mind, you help the rest of yourself heal in the process past the thought of the body's actual healing. So cheers, mate. And thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well,
back on you.
Okay, that's going to bring me back to you with this piece, Pink Backpack by Jack Kopelman. So whenever you are ready.
Okay. The Pink Backpack by Jack Kopelman. The police sent back the bullet-riddled pink backpack her daughter wore to school that day in Texas, school so close to over fourth graders like little jumping beans and fireworks, itching and squirming to run, jump, play, and swim all July, August, like frogs on logs, hunting bugs and snakes, catching butterflies and tadpoles, throwing milkweed spores to the four winds, and all the neat stuff fourth graders do that grown-ups just can't grasp. That day, the teacher screamed in the room. In the room now! The ebon-haired mother screamed too at the black-pack pink and now reddish-brown, knees buckling voice, shaking. Dios mia, madre de Dios, Dios mia. Knives piercing my chest. High-caliber bullets built to kill. Dios mia. And then, oh, this one's going to be a hard one. Gene, you want to lead us?
You know, a painful piece, for sure. You know, the shootings in the schools are so unbelievable. You know, I just can't, I don't know, I can't wrap my head around it. I'm sure most people can't. And to have such a vivid accounting here, you know, you go from a, you know, the ebon-haired mother scream too at the backpack, pink and now reddish brown. What a horrible image that is. I mean, he accomplished something with the visual, but what a horrible visual it really is when you think about the instances surrounding it. So Jack, well written as always. You know, painful. Painful piece. All right. So thank you for sharing.
That it was. Thank you, Jean. And Emmy, how about you?
Well, he went about this in a very indirect way, which I think is often more effective than just going like right for the gut. But like the police sent back the bullet-riddled pink backpack her daughter wore to school. I mean, there's a certain coldness to that where it's like this, you know, something terrible has happened, but, you know, it's never directly stated what happened. And I think that's just a really powerful way to express that. And I think another thing that was really, really well done was these depictions of just these activities like little jumping beans and fireworks, itching and squirming, catching butterflies and tadpoles, blowing milkweed spores to the four winds. I mean, all of this stuff is just kind of sort of setting up like what's kind of being lost in this process, and it makes for a much more painful piece because it's an insertion of humanity within the victims such that they're not just like these, you know, blank faces, you know, so it kind of forces you to, like, be closer to that in a way. And that, again, is just really, really effective writing. But, yeah, very, very painful piece, sort of like the last one, but, yeah.
Wonderful, Emmy. Thank you very much. And Colin, how about you?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that struck me about this is what's actually missing from it, and that's the shooter. Yeah, there's no reference at all, right, to really the shooter or the perpetrator or anything, right? It's just this pink backpack. It's this, you know, almost idyllic imagery of innocent youth, and then it's something happens. Right, but, you know, this teacher screamed in the room, and they're now, and then it's just the horrifying cries of the mother, you know, Madre de Dios, right, which is impactful, which makes it just completely senseless, and almost impersonal, and even more terrible. So, yeah, it's horrifying, but it's very effective, and the juxtaposition between the innocent images of youth, or really childhood, right, against the horrifying realities of adulthood are compelling.
Another great comment. Thank you, Dave, Colin. And both you and Emmy are right. Those first two, first page and a half, it's kind of stark, dark. And then that note to the interrogatory of what the kids should and might have been doing just a couple of days later, the jumping beans, the fireworks, the hunting bugs, the snakes, the butterflies, tadpoles, the blowing milkweed, all that little stuff that we forget as adults, but kids take great pleasure in. And then that, again, that stark note, the teacher scream in the room. And then again, it does come across as impersonal. And you're right, he doesn't mention the assailant. And I think that's deliberate. We need not name these people and give them their little tidbit of newsworthy preparation and notes who were there 15 minutes. They deserve nothing except an unmarked grave. And Jack notes something that I agree with in his AM. 376 police officers, not one ball between them. Bravo, Jack, on that note. There was a lot of cowardice that day, so I couldn't agree with you more. Jean, we're coming back to you.
Okie doke. Well, for my next magic trick, I have a piece here called Serendipity at the Salt Creek by David Philip Ireland. And I have an audio for that one. So let me hit the button. I know it's here.
This is a poem by David Philip Ireland, entitled Serendipity at the Salt Cake Sign. Serendipity is easy to miss. Barely a door and a window wide at the foot of an alleyway of crumbling steps tumbling down to the harbour of a little Welsh fishing town. Above the door a swinging sign, all salt-caked and creakful, wails and whimpers in the bitter winds that buffet the wheeling seagulls on their constant search for fish scraps and anything else ripe for the craw. Within, a pungent, erotic perfume hovers, a mouldering melange of folios and quartos from fathomless depths of harbored thoughts and words. And so narrow is your passage that to pass another bookish fool involves an intimacy that few bookstores can match. Volumes fall and tumble at the slightest touch. There is no order here. Here dwells pure literary chaos of a magnitude that even Dylan in his pugilist heyday could not match. Books flutter and fan, shift and rearrange, decompose and dog ear before coming up for air. Then something fell, dislodging my pince-nez, scraping my nose, drawing blood. Two printed vellum sheets, duo-toned Fortis graphics, tied with a blue silk ribbon from a distant tea dance hosted at a London salon in 1949. A temptation of exotic things seldom tasted since before the war, promises of Epicurean delights, of foxtrots and waltzes, of grand cru from hallowed cellars sparkling into elegant flutes, while I was busy being born. I was less than exotic, a skinned rabbit strapped to a board, a father's disappointment in a distempered room at the circus. But small miracles happen. Here my little slice of history, my serendipitous birthday card, my hour, my day, my month, my year, my celebration feast, my mother's survival, and the disdain, the look in my father's eyes. In that one monumental shift, I was connected to a bygone age, this ancient document confirming my own passage of time. The bookseller did not share my wonder. He could not have been less interested. He searched for small change and grumbled in his tight window seat, surrounded by his precarious walls of books and ephemera. Serendipity crumbles on in the little fishing town at the edge of the world. I come across the card from time to time. It remains a touchstone, nestling among the ephemera of my own brief life, full of serendipitous moments, all burned into a genetic memory for those who will follow me when I am gone.
Thank you very much for the SoundCloud there, David. I see you've noted that the vocal was done by Nick Cameron Jones. It is very much appreciated. Thank you very much. And Emmy, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, there's a lot. There's definitely a lot to go off of because it is a very long poem. But I think probably my favorite stanza, funnily enough, was I was less than exotic, a skinned rabbit strapped to a board, a father's disappointment in a distempered room at the circus. And then just the memory of the birthday card. I think the other part with the bookseller not really sharing in the wonder or the experience is another sort of great detail, just sort of tying in with the way the world tends to move on and forgets its old. But this is a great poem. I also liked kind of the voice behind it, the way it was read, being using a small amount of dramatism to kind of commemorate this moment in memory.
Excellent. Thank you, Annie. And Colin, how about you?
Yeah, I share a lot of those insights, and you know, one thing that struck me here, just on another note, is that he does mention at one point that he says, here dwells pure literary chaos of a magnitude that even Dylan in his Pugilist heyday could not match. And to me, it's almost like the poem is a send-up to Dylan Thomas, right? It almost feels like Fern Hill or one of Dylan Thomas's is the poems about youth, right, in the Welsh countryside. And that really strikes me. And he's clearly heavily influenced by Thomas and his poetics. But yeah, I mean, there's such lush, beautiful imagery here with this kind of seaside bookstore and then kind of the pubs and this atmosphere that just draws in the reader. And yeah, the serendipity is just this moment that strikes the poet, right? The something that they experience, which is profoundly impactful to him, but completely trivial, right, to the bookseller. And everything ultimately, recedes into the vacuum of time. So yeah, nicely done. It's a lot to unpack here. I'll have to look at it more.
Excellent. Thank you, Colin. Jean, how about you? Oh, Jean.
Yes. I'm back. I'm so sorry. I have to agree with Colin. I think it's a lot here to be taken in such a short period of time. But I thought it was a wonderfully penned piece, and I thought it was very well expressed. As always, it was an exceptional piece, an exceptional work, and the audio was excellent as well. I don't know. I mean, his audios are always incredible, so this one kind of, I wasn't expecting a voice like that. I think usually his is music, isn't it, Rex? He has a musical kind of audio.
Yeah, somebody else read this for him.
Right. So when I heard this, I was like, wait a minute, they're not singing. So that was kind of a change. And I thought it was just a great job and really well planned. So thank you, David, for sharing with us, as always. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. That whole first section, the amount of time and detail that he went into describing the town, even to the point of above the door, a swinging sign, all salt-caked and creakful, wails and whimpers in the bitter winds that buffet the wheeling seagulls on their constant search for fish scraps and anything else ripe for the craw. And it continues that with the pungent, erotic perfume hovers within the store itself, that note of aged pages. And then the thought of it's kind of set around as almost bric-a-brac, the fact that they're teetering, they're falling. And then that opening of the second part of this, then something fell, dislodging my pince-nez, scraping my nose, drawing blood. But there's that note of serendipity coming in, because at that point he gets to find out what's in that piece that just fell on him and everything he gets out of it. It was a different time back then. He mentions 1949, had just come out off the out of the war, so Europe was a bloody mess, and most of the people out of that era didn't speak of what went on, what they experienced, because they didn't want to pass that kind of horror along. So the fact that he hits that thought of his father being so stern as to look disdainful in the moment kind of comes from out of that era, and even though it might have been a joyous occasion at the moment, you still remember the horrors and the ravages of what happened just a few years earlier, and everybody's still just rebuilding. So nicely done there, David. Thank you very much. All right, Jean. Yeah, back up to you.
Okay.
Oh.
Well, let's say hello to Weaver of Dreams. Yes. Just picked her up. Hello, Kate.
Good morning, my little chickadees. How are you? I'm well.
Good evening to you.
Yeah,
good evening, my dear.
a little WC field. I'll let you know if I've got one of those. I've got a curved cue.
That sounds fairly disgusting, actually. But never mind.
Well, have you seen his? I'm talking about the cue stick he used. It had a nice curve on it, so you had to really use the shot.
That would have been very difficult. Very, very
absolutely
difficult. Oh, well, back to sanity then.
What? Did you happen to hear that piece, my friend?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't. I was trying to get on, and I tried to remember what my name was, so I missed it.
Listen to it later. You'll enjoy it.
I will. Thank you very much.
Yes. I think you will. Absolutely. Let's see what I have now. I have a piece for you, Emmy, by EJ Cool. And whenever you are ready.
Okay. All right. So this is Landfill by EJ Cool. Sorry. Nothing says I love you quite so poignantly as a giant stinking mess. Piles of ragged rubber tires reach inert fingers to the sky like expired insects. Fecal matter plastered luggage, repurposed murder victim Tupperware bargain, rusted out bottom oblong mouths of cast iron pots and pans vomit black carbon. Mountains of moldy newspaper, fax shreddings, and unused styrofoam cups, compressed plastic bottle cubes breed their own chain-linked misanthropic ecosystems. Human waste upon bifurcated human waste, occipital and spinal snaps, cracked porcelain clawfoot tubs, double as temporary housing and lead death traps. Leachate streams join the rancid juice of cola-soaked rotting produce and meat, foul food for the landfill's mutant flies, generation 853. Old crows and pigeons recycled by carrion vultures, fungal forms, and plague rats, a feast for outcast beggars closely watched by the uneven eyes of feral cats. And
great read, Emmy. Thank you very much. All right, Kate, we're going to start with you since you just came into the room.
That's right. Pick on a little old lady. Typical. Oh, I thought this was incredible. Blimmin' heck. I mean, that is your landfill. That says it all. Nothing says I love you quite so poignantly as a giant stinking mess. Beautifully. I mean, look, you had to read after those first two lines, didn't you? Amazing. I mean, kind of yuck, but, you know, amazing. I loved it. I thought it rolled beautifully off the tongue, as did the cola-soaked rotting produce. Beautifully executed, I think. You can see it, you can smell it, and you can even see that steam rising as everything rots away. Oh, I wouldn't say beautiful, I would say very, very clever and very artistic and getting the point across. And I thought it was amazing. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Kate. And Colin, how about you?
Yeah, I thought this was terrific. You know, I was just commenting on it. It said it's just this intense imagery which piles upon itself in a horrifying and effective way, like a landfill, right? I mean, it's just one abomination after another, like, you know, just one thing piled upon another. But what's great here is the way that she, you know, the poet kind of ties in these anthropomorphic kind of human elements into this landfill, because, you know, if you look at a landfill, sometimes you think you see what appears to be a skull, right, or a hand, or, you know, a jawbone or something, when it really isn't, right? It's like a piece of a bathtub or a sink or, you know, something like that. So these things are just these horrible accretions or amalgamations of just all the refuse and just nastiness of you know, our world all thrown into one place. And of course, I also like the rhymes, too, and how she ties everything, especially the last one, the fungal forms and plague rats, a feast for outcast beggars, closely watched by the uneven eyes of feral cats. Right, so very close attention to the musicality and to the rhyme scheme that the poem uses. So, yeah, I thought this was great. This was a lot of fun.
Excellent. Thank you, Colin. Jean, how about you?
Well, I can say yuck, right? Wonderfully described, I have to say. You know, each line was, better than the one before. And, I mean, when it comes to a landfill or the dump, I think she's got it all nailed down. And it was a well-deserved gold in that con, in the dumps. You know, I mean, just really, really, just incredible. I mean, as you're reading it, you're going, All right, it makes perfect sense. So, excellent job, and thank you, Sarah and EJ. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jean. And, Amy, you got to read it. How about you?
I never knew it all. Yeah, I actually wrote a comment, but I think it was like, it's bizarre how it's like such a detailed and beautifully written piece, and it's about a landfill. I think the rusted out bottom oblong mouths of cast iron pots and pans vomit black carbon is definitely one of my favorite lines. Because it just has so much detail and just a really, really strong verb sort of in the middle of that. And this is just really just kind of just piled high with detail, almost as if to kind of explain that there's just a great variety of different things and that kind of go in the landfill, and that the core theme of it is that it's all being like wasted at the end of the day. I think I really like the sort of biological or sort of species twist, because it mentions flies, carrion vultures, plague rats, and then feral cats as well. Towards the end, leachate streams. I believe that is essentially just the leaching of the waste from the landfill getting into streams, getting into like the groundwater supply, which is an actual issue. So that was also a really brilliant part. But yeah, there's a lot to love about this.
Great comments, Urban. You're right. There's some great lines in here. Repurposed murder victim Tupperware bargain. Yeah, that's quite the thought, and probably accurate too, as well as the human waste upon bifurcated human waste, occipital and spinal snap. The landfill mutant flies is another nice touch. I like the thought, generation 853. Most people don't think what would they reduce the generation down to. It's the thought of every 25 years. So this kind of hits on the note of 2,000 years, or a little more than 2,000 years of a consistent buildup of the same, or the same and the newest version of the same of garbage that's being tossed. I feel like sort of old clothes and pigeons recycled by carrion vultures. Again, a great line, but also true. Fungal forms and plague rats, a feast for outcast beggars. Great thought there. Closely watched by the uneven eyes of feral cats. Yes, quite the rancid piece, and definitely odiferous in its nature. Thank you, EJ. All right, Jean.
Nice. Okay. I have the next one up for you called Transcontinental by Cedar Chapman.
Who's got this one? Me?
For Colin, yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, for me, okay. This is Transcontinental. The valley screams and eerie cry. Cinder smoke spews to blackened skies. the Iron Marvel chugs along, whistling its steamy victory song, while midnight sued on broken faces, shovel coal with mindless haste, while suits blur and rush and race to fill the seats in first-class spaces. Power voice still lingers with the clangy clangor of iron spikes and iron hammers. Hear us wallow with painful cries, bullwhips, sallow, pigtails decried. Oh, preachers, share such serpent lies of brighter days, just so kings and rulers may feed their gold-lust eyes. Black granite tunnels have no light. We tiptoe to the depths of night and carry liquid devil's breath, two silver tails to barter death. And should we die, let our last breath loudly cry. Let northern winds rage and blow. Let our voices flow high and low. Ghosts shall haunt and fly on by in shadows deep and far below, lest our mothers will never know. Wild fodder, soaked in creosote, stuffed in coffins, ash and tossed, yet not single white newsprint wrote, as one by one each forgotten oriental sun lost and vanished in western gloat. The transcontinental rolls along, tooting its steamy triumphant song. Barons and lords all hop aboard. Let's enjoy the ride. Weave espresso inside. Red velvet, brass, and oak shell hide. The blood-stained cogs and the shut-eye Asian feral hogs, skewered by rods and nickel steel, crimson iron wheels. All rise, all rise. Treasure man's golden prize. This fine country, this fine western pride. End poem.
Great read there. Colin, thank you very much. And Emmy, why don't we start with you, please?
Yeah, so this was more or less about Chinese immigrants and their help constructing the railways, which was definitely, pardon the vacuum in the background, but sorry. It was definitely a darker time within the history of America in particular. And I think this was a very biting poem, how it establishes this this like triumphant victory song, this Iron Marvel that chugs along, whistling its steamy victory song, while midnight suit on broken faces. It's just a very, a very telling piece on exploitation of the working class, and especially of like Chinese immigrants at the time. Great piece.
Thank you, Emmy. And Kate, how about you?
Oh, I agree with you totally, Emmy. I love doing these things because I learn things that I never ever knew, and this really bites hard. Why is it always lower classes are stood upon? Are ladders for people with more money to climb on them and squash them and just get ahead. We all think it's awful. Of course we do. And 2020 vision in hindsight, you just wish somebody could have done something for them sooner, but different times. And I hope that we all learn from these kind of things and realize that people are people. And they get hurt and they get tired like everybody else. So yes, I thought it was very hard hitting. Very well written. And thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you, Kate. And Jean, how about you? Colin, how about you? You got to read it.
Sure. Some of the things that struck me here are the way that the musicality of the piece and how the triumphant song of the railroad juxtaposes with those who constructed it, right? This triumphant noise of the locomotive as it seems across the land versus the songs of the men who suffered, right, as they built this thing. The other thing that struck me, too, is the kind of almost mythical or subhuman elements of these tunnels that they built, right, with a liquid devil's breath, right, that they had to carry. There were obviously these demonic passages and everything that went through. And that's all subhuman, but the railroad itself is inhuman, right? And what it did to the men that who built it. But what's interesting too about this, I think, at least because I can read the poem against itself in some ways, in that there still seems to almost be an element of pride in what they built in this that kind of comes out despite the exploitation and the suffering, which makes the thing even more interesting to me. So that's my insight.
Nice call there, Colin. There's a particular piece that section that I found almost it's kind of like an ode. Black granite tunnels have no light. We tiptoe to the depths of night and carry liquid devil's breath to silver tails to bark in death. And should we die, let our last breath loudly cry, let northern winds rage and blow, let our voices flow high and low. Ghosts shall haunt and fly on by in shadows deep and far below, lest our mothers will never know. A great passage there, and a kind of a note as to those souls that didn't get their recognition, because you look at that picture there, you won't see one Chinese worker in that picture itself. They're all white workers, and does speak to a very, very different age and time through history. Jean, you back yet?
I am back, and I apologize, but I'm going to tell you what. This is a great piece, and I thought it was it captured the I have to reopen it because I shut it down. I thought it was an excellent piece and a great capture of the truth behind the railroad. You know, because not everything is just all glitter and glitz. You know, and I thought it was just well written and well done. Yeah, it was a great job, and I'm gonna skip out on the rest of the commenting because I want to get a few more pieces in tonight. So but I will write comments. Okay, so let me see now. Miss Weaver Girl, I have a piece for you. Okay, this is Memories Unpainted by Lulu Wildo. Thank you.
Thank you, my dear. Just give me a second. I'll get that up. And there we are. Got it. Memories unpainted. Waking, surrounded in denial. Regret falls in sheet of rain. Giving love to the unforgiving. Hope now dreams in nothing. Why try to survive? Why are you reflected in my tears? Why awaken in rising sunshine? Why do I no longer believe? My mistake is not my deep emotions. They are the lost dreams that crash in starless insomnia. Memories unpainted, they fade. Again they fade. Still tasting regrets, my lips quiver. Why try to survive? Why are you reflected in my tears? Why awaken in rising sunshine? Why do I no longer believe? Childish hopes had risen above scarred agonies. The metal mirror now distorts hopeless eyes, reflecting drops of memories, a broken heart, meaningless words. I need more than lust to breathe. End poem.
Great read, Kate. Thank you very much. And Colin, why don't we start with you, please?
Okay, yeah, this is the first time I've seen this, so yeah, the first thing that strikes me is the last stanza, right? And I love this, you know, the last line. I need more than lust to breathe, right? Which is great, but it's also somewhat perplexing in the sense that, you know, we keep seeing this refrain, you know, why try to survive? And I'm not quite sure if it's the poet who's asking herself, I have to assume it's a her, that, you know, she's asking herself if she's supposed to survive or the memory of something is supposed to survive, right? Or the experience, right? It's something that has to be held up to survive longer, right? Like an image. So that part is you know, worth unpacking. But, you know, and also I really like this, you know, my mistake is not deep emotions. They are the lost dreams that crash in startless insomnia. I like that too, right? It's not just insomnia, it's startless insomnia, right? It's just the blackness, right, which is very interesting. So, yeah, I look forward to seeing what, you know, or hearing what other people have to think of it.
Excellent. Thank you, Colin. Andy, how about you?
Yeah, I really like this, and the why are you reflected in my tears? Why try to survive? Reading that backwards, I know, but that was a really interesting kind of thing where it's almost like kind of saying goodbye to somebody, or rather just looking in the mirror, right, or something to that effect. That was sort of repeated twice, so I think just kind of asking that question, like, why am I here? Why am I waking up? That kind of stuff, which is a lot different from like an outward desire for like death, you could say. It's a lot more passive, but significant nonetheless. And then there's just the metal mirror now distorts hopeless eyes, which was a fantastic detail to kind of include, sort of like actually looking at yourself and seeing kind of the look in your eyes, which it's a lot to like relate to in this, and it's a really good piece.
Thank you, Emmy. And Kate, you got to read it. How about you?
Oh, it was lovely. It was lovely to read, and it's so deep and so. Oh, the regret is obvious there. I mean, regret falls in sheets of rain. Oh, it's very. Yes, it. Sorry, it kind of got to me a little bit. This one, it's sad, but I don't know. There's hope there somehow. It seems to be, you know, that no matter what, there is still hope. The dreams might not be totally lost, and they might not totally fade either. But that stale tasting regrets, my lips quiver. I found that so moving. I found the whole thing very moving, and it was beautifully written. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Julia. It was lovely.
Thank you, Kate. You're right. This is very painfully sad, and it hits on my guess is there's some death in here because of that. That thought of, let's see, I need more than lust to breathe offers up that note, kind of all the past loves, especially the thought with memories and everything that the tasting regrets is the past loves, they're all dead or have passed on, so to speak. The scarred agonies that the metal mirror now distorts over size. There's that reflection of what once was, that the beauty in the hope of being in love, and those questions are there to why try to survive, why are you reflected in my tears, why awaken in the mid and rising sunshine, why do I no longer believe that there's a note to loss of being abandoned, or feeling abandoned, rather. All right, Dean, we're back on you.
Okay, guys. Great comments, everybody, really. Okay, the next piece I'm going to put up is by Poetic Picasso, and I have an audio for that one. So, let me hit the button.
For centuries, I've guarded you from the distant amber horizon faithfully, as the sable shuttle of the night under the gleaming crescent moon, watching you grow in the metal of two clovers, ivory jasmines, and mauve violets. Your buttercup curls sparkle under a periwinkle sky, enriched with the smell of blueberries. In the ebony darkness, I fly high above the topaz starlight, longing to appear before you, are the luminous, pearly glow. Sing to you the musical notes from my gold harmonic harp, resounding, let the silver strings play, the dulcet tone of my whistling whispers. You wait to see me streaking across the vast sphere of the universe, and you call out my name and seek me with the beating of your heart. I am guided by the radiance of your aquamarine eyes, gliding through the foam of puffy clouds to reach you amongst the flamencos. I wash your wild tears as you hold me in your warm embrace, as I emerge from the darkness like a sable shadow with my blackberry wings. To die within the serenity of your comforting arms as I fade away, taking my last final breath before the beauty of your ginger flesh.
Great read, Frank. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. All right, Kate, what do you think?
Well, I don't think for one second you could get another color into this particular piece of poetry. It is beautifully covered in this rainbow of images and items and colors and periwinkle sky, enriched with the smell of blueberries. How sweet is that? Yeah, this is a beautiful ode to somebody who is luminous and pearly and glowing very brightly. I love the imagery, and sing to you the musical notes from my gold harmonic harp, resounding, let the silver strings play the dulcet tones of my whistling whispers. Yeah, beautiful. Very well done, and I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you. Emmy, how about you?
Yeah, I thought there were just lines here that were just really kind of soaked with detail and imagery, such as like your buttercup curls sparkle under a periwinkle sky enriched with the smell of blueberries. It's a very this glorious and kind of embellished piece with just a lot of stuff here. And yeah, I do agree with Weaver in terms of like the use of color. Gliding through the foam of puffy clouds is just another great kind of line in there. But yeah, that's about what I had.
Thank you, Emmy. And Colin, how about you?
Yeah, I don't have too much to add. I do like this idea of the sable shadow, right? And which is an interesting image. And certainly, I emerged from the darkness like a sable shadow with my blackberry wings, right? With this, you know, very beautiful image. And I guess there's a little lower down, if you scroll down, there's actually a picture, I guess, which is the prompt, which you know, served as a prompt for the poem, right, of this, like, this black-winged angel, right, embracing this girl. So it's kind of an exploration of that, in which, you know, kind of beautifully illustrates the picture and brings it to life. So, yeah, it's nicely done.
Excellent. Thank you. I guess the only thing I can add to that, do you remember the movie Ghost? I got this.
Oh,
this
yeah.
Kind of walked mm-hmm. that very same tempo, but with the him as the ghost offering up the sword before passing on to that next realm. The idea of explaining to her as best he could what he sees in the moment as he's before he passes on, watching you grow in the meadow of teal clovers, ivory jasmines, mauve violets, your buttercup curls sparkle under a periwinkle sky and rich with the smell of blueberries. And then that thought of I fly above the topaz starlight longing to appear before you as a luminous pearly glow. Then the thought with the gold harp resounding gives that note to someone who is already passed but wanting to spend just one last moment with them. So nicely done, Frank. All right, Jane.
Okie dokie. Emiliana, I have the next one up. I know I said that wrong. Emiliana, from what I'm reading. Your piece is up next, son. So whenever you're ready. Something sweet? Yes.
Okay. All right. This is something sweet. On my website, I referred to it as like honey. That was more for SEO purposes, but yeah. Okay. Sunlight limps through shacked panes, breaking against black hair hugged by dust-stained beads of gasoline. Lip mantle splits in flakes like spring onion skins dried, and I slept in oiled grass that gripped my clothes like honey. He called me that name. It was his way of infantilizing me, to clog my receptors like neurotoxins and daze me. I remember pebbles locked in concrete rivers digging in my heels. Pronged shadows shift where the wind tugs branches and chokes my view of the sky. It dries maroon lipstick on gutters hung above jasmine rice complexion skin where the wood grain blisters lined to windows speckled in dirt with curtain guards colored molasses that, like our towering oak door, chewed and swallowed us. I walk in black leather working shoes tied to my ankles below 2.7 feet of linen, pulled over black stumps with shoulders tucked inside a logo t-shirt. Arms slack, wide strides on an 80-degree Fahrenheit evening where telephone wire heaves breaths between poles and traffic lights bleed out in the gaze of car lines, and I wonder if I fell into the path of a bus. Would the wind lull my blood-coated hair and waves riding past cheekbones, skinned on asphalt? Will I soak into the road's black pores like squirrel carcasses, clots hugging my scalp like honey where all sleep, until they peel me off and pave over my stains to smear a fresh white band separating petal skeletons from gas elephants? I still cook with honey. It rolls over hills of carrots and broccoli seared with dark soy sauce and red cabbage. Lime juice cuts through its body and nibbles at my fingers, an ingredient, not a name anymore. And
great
Paul.
Read, Annie. Thank you very much. And Kate, why don't we start with you?
Thank you, my dear. This is so... It's so deep. I feel hurt and pain, and the name honey, obviously, as you have said, was used to infantilize you, and I'm obviously glad it didn't at the end, because you could then use it. You could use it in your cooking, and it was just an ingredient and not a name that could hurt anymore. I think this was very beautifully written, and an awful lot of fabulous image. It got to me. So thank you very much for that. It was wonderful.
Thank you, Dave. And Colin, how about you?
Yeah, I read this a little bit earlier tonight, and I thought it's just, I said it was a gorgeous and moving poem. I'm looking through it, and you know, what strikes me obviously is these lush images that are at once earthy and almost dirty, right, with the gasoline and the dirt and everything else, but also, you know, sweet, you know, like honey or you know, a delicate that kind of are pulled together in this poem. It's interesting, too. I have to make certain assumptions about it, and I guess that, you know, the one stanza which says I walk in black leather working shoes tied to my ankles below 2.7 feet of linen. At least I thought, or at least I imagined a niqab or an abaya, right, or something like that, right, where, like, for instance, like women in Tehran wear black leather shoes, right, but, you know, niqabs or abayas, like, you know, Muslim dress, right. I don't know if that's correct, but that's kind of what it seemed to me, you know, as the linen. So there's this sense of being obscured, right, or this sense of not being seen. And then this fascinating, you know, second to last stanza where the poet imagines herself basically, you know, run over by a bus, right, and what would happen, right, and what the wind would do, or what people would think, you know, or not even what people would think, but what would happen to her. And then, of course, we're pulled back to the present with I still cook with honey, right? And it's almost like these fleeting memories or these recollections, right, of a time before. But, yeah, I thought the poem's terrific, and I thought it's really compelling. There's a ton to unpack here, and you could just pour over it and try to, like, you know, discover everything that's within it. But definitely well done.
Excellent. Thank you there, Colin. Emmy, the thought you've got in here with black, there's a lot of black that walks within us. I remember pebbles locked in concrete rivers digging in my heels. There's almost a note to walking on eggshells in that moment. And then you hit that thought with like our tearing oak door chewed and swallowed us. There's a note to that which goes on behind closed doors. But the reference to black almost has a note of mourning, because I walk in black leather working shoes and ties to my ankles below 2.7 feet of linen pulled over black stumps with shoulders tucked inside a logo t-shirt. There's almost a note to a burial, insignificance, and I wonder if I fell into the path of a bus. And then again, the road's black, like squirrel carcasses. There is a notion of, with that, the harshness of that stanza itself. It's like not the metaphor being being hit so hard that it takes the breath out of you in such a way with the reality of the voice itself. And like Kate pulled up, that note to honey is both stark and revealing within that second stanza. And then to finish it with I still cook with honey, it drools over hills of carrots and broccoli seared with the dark soy sauce and red cabbage, again, reference to dark. So there's an almost mournful note to the whole piece itself. There is a sadness in it, too. So thank you very much. All right, Jean, we're coming back your way.
Okie dokie, thank you very much. Emmy, that was an excellent piece, and I did leave a written comment for you. Well done. Okay, for my next piece, I have C. Francis Higgins. Now, if we know who he is, maybe he can read this for us. Just kidding, Colin. Here we go. It's up whenever you're ready.
Sure. Okay, this is The Absence of the Effigy. The absence is the effigy, a form where no form is found, on dusty wood floors, under broken barren windows, sea swept, slathering in rot. The ruined house is lurching, gathered into an ocean, furious foam, and ardent embraces like some encroaching lunacy. The black rooms beckon, and the dancing wind moves through this space around what was once perishing in yellow. And all this will fall into salt-crusted violence while the abandoned heart constructs green monuments floating in flotsam. The formless forgetfulness amid scattering shipwrecks is a lover's cry that makes a masterpiece out of memory.
Home. Great read, Colin. Thank you very much. And Emmy, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, there was a lot of good stuff in here. The ruined house is lurching was one great moment here. The formless sort of forgetfulness and sort of feeling of like being washed away, you could say, and also almost being forgotten in that sense. So yeah, lovely read. I'll definitely have to unpack more of this stuff as well later.
Thank you, Abby. Okay, how about you?
Well, there was so much in this. The black rooms beckon, and the dancing wind moves through the space around what was once perishing in yellow. And all of this will fall into salt-crested violence. Oh, yes, so much going on here, definitely. I love the picture, of course. I mean, that's a wild sea, isn't it? Mm. The ruined house is lurching, gathered into an ocean at the alliteration of furious foam and ardent embraces. Yes, I thought this was very atmospheric, very interesting. Like you said, I mean, I think I'll have to read it again to get the full impact of it. But that last stanza. The formal forgetfulness amid scattered shipwrecks is the lover's cry that makes a masterpiece out of memory. It's just beautiful. It really is. Beautiful. So thank you very much. I enjoyed that. See you, Francis.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate. Colin, this was, it kind of hit on that note of a house itself that holds the memories of not just the love, but the tragedy, the heartache, as well as the violence that occurs within its environment. The barren windows, sea swept, gathering in rot. There's almost a stark reality to a little touch of death. The ruined house itself, ocean of furious foam and ardent embraces, like some encroaching lunacy. So there is a note to happier days, but the next one you hit on the black rooms, which kind of hit on the north, especially perishing yellow, the sort of death walks in that one. And your note with the last stanza makes a masterpiece out of a memory is the kind of note of where you can take something, and a structure or anything that you put your mind to, despite all the harbingers and the pain of sorrow that may have walked through its doors or its fields, you can offer up a touch of beauty in the moment, which helps balance the equation, so to speak.
All right, Gene.
Thanks. We're back to you. Oh, you're welcome, Colin. We're back to you, Gene.
Thank you.
I got it in.
Colin, I got to say that, you know, I found it interesting, the emptiness being the biggest testament of the subject in the poem. And sadly, sometimes our memories remain the most tangible. So I thought it was nicely penned. Very well done. Did he just chuckle at my silly little comment? He did. I heard him. Yes, yes. Okay, here we go. I didn't miss it. Okay, the next piece I'm going to put up is by Robert M., and I have an audio for that as well. So let me hit the button.
As an enigma and our greatest bane. It teaches as well as tortures, all the while paying favors to none. We are prisoners of it, though it eventually frees us all. Some are lost to it, while many never have it. Time's perilous sand is reliably brutal, and its sting is merciless to all. Every grain warping, withering, shaping, and in the end, destroying all that we are. As the tiny fragments of hope slip through your hands, that fading spark of humanity flickers for a brief moment in the realization that we are all but a gleam upon the great hourglass.
Robert, thank you very much for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. Kate, how about you start it?
Oh, of course, thank you. Time. This is something we have long discussions about. Sometimes it goes so fast, it's like a blink of an eye, if you're enjoying yourself. And other times, if you're not, it goes so slowly. You can't believe how long 1 minute can be. And we are all prisoners of it. Although it is something that is, we've discussed again, something that is man-made, we have to have time to regulate our lives, or nobody would bother getting up and going to work, would they, really? So I think this is covers it beautifully. It gives you all the aspects of time and what it can and can't do, what it will and won't do for you. You've got to make the most of it. As the tiny fragments of hope slip through your hands, that fading spark of humanity flickers for a brief moment in the realization that we are all are but a gleam upon the great hourglass. Now that's a lovely ending stanza, isn't it? It just takes the whole thing together for you. Yes, I thought it was wonderful. Thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you, Kate. Colin, how about you?
Yeah, well, there's almost like Heraclitian elements here, right? It's the comfort in really, or the kind of comfort that we receive in knowing that we're just, you know, part of this inexorable, you know, kind of march of time, and that we're just this, you know, but a gleam upon the great hourglass, right? That our time is brief, but we kind of fit into the whole. Which is both terrifying but comforting in such a way. So I think that's kind of what the poet was, you know, maybe striving for here. At least that's my impression. I commented too that there's elements of stoicism in here, but I now looking at it more, I think it's more Heraclitian the whole way the thing, you know, unfolds. So but it's clever and it's a fun poem.
Excellent. Thank you, Colin. And Emmy, how about you?
Well, this sort of reminds me of a separate poem by Edgar Allan Poe, I believe, on the holding kind of the sand in your hands and not being able to keep it sort of within. But I recall, I think, Robert sort of... I could be totally wrong, but I believe he was inspired by Edgar Allan Poe, so there may definitely be elements of that here. I think the line that really stood out to me was, every grain warping, withering, shaping, and in the end destroying. So it's not just a process of destruction that's taking place, but it's also change over time. So it's sort of capturing like the aging process that I just don't see as often in poems that talk sort of about the impact of time. So great.
Nice, I like that thought there. Thank you very much. I guess I can only offer up one thing. It hits me as a sort of if you live and breathe for time, then you fail to live and breathe in the moments that tick away within that time. So that's the thought of those grains of sand slipping through your fingers because you're wasting too much time thinking about the time it's doing rather than actually living through it. Nicely done, Robert. All right, Jane.
Good chat. We got one. I'm going to put one more up, and this is going to be by Titus Llewellyn, and we'll have carryovers. Sometimes that's all you can reach. So here we go.
Slates of hands. With hand on cleft, I am suspicious of behind me. that the same be placed before a part of me be left, when right thereof ignored before all that which left it saw. I have my eyes on that which headed right, as learned it as I might have been before, the turn of hand would single stage its slight, to touch what my unknowing sensed I saw. What agedness is this which part mutates, the younger version of the one I saw? Have I so far left nothing which creates a lesser worthy figure than before? I'm old, I know that all of me is left, behind the right idea that which I saw, was never to accuse the hand of theft, unless they are attached, as was before.
Great read there, Tony. Thank you for the sound cloud. It was very much appreciated. And Colin, why don't we start with you, please?
Yeah, well, again, this one is another philosophic poem, right? The hands that you know, at least it seems to me that one is aged or reminds the poet of his age, right? And the other one, which it obscures. It's interesting. There's a lot to unpack here. This is the first time I've really seen this. It's a puzzling kind of poem, the way it kind of unfolds and you know, with this interesting concept and conceit. I'd be interested to see what other people think of it.
All right, thank you, Colin. Amy, how about you?
Yeah, I did notice a very kind of particular and constrained rhyme and rhythm aspect of this poem that definitely kind of makes for a language that is more embellished upon, you could say. The part that was sort of interesting to me was never to accuse the hands of theft unless they are attached, as was before. I don't know exactly where or why, but it sort of reminds me of like the practice of cutting off the hands of convicted thieves, being that kind of thing of like, if they aren't attached, I can't accuse them of theft, which is, it's sort of an interesting, almost like a flip around of that, but I may just be completely misunderstanding it. But yeah, it's an interesting, right?
Thank you, Abby. And Kate, how about you?
Well, very interesting poem. Very interesting. I'm more looking at how the poem itself has been put together than I was actually listening to the words, if you know what I mean, because I could see the different juxtaposition of phrases the way you wouldn't expect to have them, and that was what I noticed a lot of the time. So I would have to read it again and not pay attention to the way it's constructed, but more to what is actually being said, which is, I suppose, really, you're leaving behind your youth and you're going onwards to old age, and you don't think there's really that much left for you. You're not the worthy figure that you were before. So yes, it's a lament, as far as I could see, to time passing and age catching up with us. But very cleverly written and very enjoyable. Thank you.
Nice catch there, Kate. I got to add in a little something. The left and the right. To me, that points to the brain, the analytical to the creative end. And it's offering up both, and the cleft being that section, the middle section of the brain where everything fires across the mouth, so to speak. There's a thought of, I have my eyes on that which headed right, as learned as I might have been before. The turn of hand with single stage its flight, touch what my unknowing sense I saw. There is a note to a trouble, a note to introspection of well, maybe I spent too much of life on this angle instead of incorporating this other, which speaks to a deeper sense of self. And you're right. I think the back end of this does hint on the thought of age and how we progress in age and thought. And it kind of hits on that note of I wish I knew then what I do know now, as a thought to life might have been a little bit more different. All right, Jean, we're back to you.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank everybody. I want to thank you, Colin and Emmy and Kate, for calling in. Rex, I want to thank you, as always, for hanging out with me and hosting, whichever. I appreciate you very much. I want to thank everyone for providing us with poetry for this evening. If you did not hear your piece read tonight, rest assured it will be on the show next week. I don't know. Time really got away from me. I must have fallen asleep somewhere because I woke up and we had a lot of poems left. I'm like, wow, I thought we were making good time. But, so we'll definitely be making those poems. And as always, I want to thank everyone. I appreciate everyone's contributions to the show. And, we'll have another great week next week. We have Gonzo, and we have Andoshino, and we have Jack Blue, and Betty Page, and Dark and Auras, and Eric Daniel Herman. Those are the carryovers. And everyone is going to make sure I say it one more time. There is no Parts Inner, Parts Saint this evening. As I said, Fabian is not feeling well, and Babbler is away. So just so everybody's aware. And you all have a wonderful night and a great weekend. And I will see you all. I'll hear everybody on Sunday. So thank you for that. And Grand Funk, remember
good night,
that.
Gang.
It's a Sunday show.
Good night,
everybody.
Thanks.
Good
night.
Mm-hmm. Good night.
Thank
you for having me.
It's always good to have you guys. Mm-hmm.